Welcome to the Thriving Birth Worker Podcast, a space for conversations about how you, the birth worker, can create not only a fulfilling and sustainable career, but a joyful and thriving life. I'm Erin Underwood, an educator, movement specialist, mother of four boys, and a total anatomy nerd. My passion is to see birth workers encouraged, supported, and empowered in their careers and life.
Hello, friends. I'm your host, Erin, and today I'm wanting to tell you about one simple and powerful practice you can start implementing in your own life today to move from surviving into thriving, both in your business and also your career, your personal life, which is what we are all about here in the Thriving Birthworker community. But before we dive into this conversation, I wanted to let you know something that is coming down the pipe, which I'm super excited about. I'm going to be launching a YouTube channel, which is going to be a concentrated effort to support and provide access for the birthworking community with tutorials and exercises to support your body as you move through your life. A few of the topics include how to address foot pain, like 12-hour plus shifts with a hospital floor, how to maneuver around a birth tub without killing your back or feeling just really awkward or clumsy, hand stretches and strengthening exercises to support you before and after long periods of applying counter pressure. These are just a few of my ideas. I've got a lot. But what I'd love to hear from you is if there's anything specific you'd like to see on the channel. I would appreciate any and all ideas that would serve you. So if you could just drop me an email at erinunderwoodmovement@gmail.com, you can just title it YouTube ideas or hey there, and I'll be super excited to integrate some of your ideas as I'm creating all this content for the Thriving Birth Worker community. And I will definitely keep you posted as soon as we go live. So for today's episode, I wanted to start off with a story. So we're going to have story time with Erin for a moment. So when I was, I don't remember exactly, 8 or 9 years old, I went to outdoor school for the first time. So this was my first time being away from home for that long. I think it's like a 4 or 5 night camp stay. So you're out at camp and you're doing all these science experiments and hiking and you're just in nature learning all about all of the things. And so I was super excited. I got to go with my best friend. I knew some other kids there. It was also like a bunch of kids I didn't know. It was just going to be super exciting. So I'm like really pumped. And we get there, we get set up, we get our, you know, your gear dropped off, you get assigned to a cabin, you do the whole thing. And the first night, I remember they're, you know, explaining the schedule for the week and, you know, where different things are and answering questions. And they were also talking about if they reminded all the kids, they're like, okay, guys, if you have food, that's not a problem, but we ask that you give it to your camp counselor, because if you keep your food in your backpack or in your suitcase, animals and critters can get into it. And you can have like basically a mouse or whatever, like tear up your stuff because they're looking for your food. So like you can have your food whenever you want, but if you give it to your camp counselor, they'll keep it in like this container where the animals can't get to it. So I was like, okay, check, I'll do that. So that night, you know, gave it to my counselor. We're all good to go. Whatever snacks I had, I don't remember. So slept through the night, super excited, wake up the next morning and, you know, it's cold in the cabin. So I grab my clothes and I crawl in back into my sleeping bag to get changed because you don't want to get changed out in the cold air. And, you know, I change my pants and then I go to put my foot in my sock and there's something in my sock. Like legitimately, I should put my foot in there and I feel my toes touch something that isn't sock. And I just scream. I am like, there is a mouse or there is a bug or there is something in my sock. Like there is a critter who went into my sock looking for food. And so I'm like panicking. My best friend crawls up into the bunk bed with me and is like trying to problem solve this with me. And she's like poking at the sock and I'm poking at the sock. And we're just two little girls who are freaking out. And my counselor finally comes over. It's like, what is going on? I'm like, there's something in my sock. And she had to save me. She's like, give me your sock. And it was really flat and it wasn't moving. And I was like, but I felt something. I promise I felt something. So she digs her hand in there and she pulls out a note from my mother. It turns out that my mom, being the sweet mother that she is, wrote little love notes or funny notes or whatever every day and shoved them in each of my socks because she had faith that I guess I would change my clothes, which I did the first day. So we're good to go there. And I just remember being so, like, it was such a mind shift because I went from like this panic to like, she's being sweet, but I'm almost like frustrated that she was being sweet because I was so startled by the whole process. And so that is probably the biggest memory I have from my first time at it outdoor school. It was a good experience. I learned a lot, but that was is just forever imprinted into my memory of the panic that I experienced and the just being convinced that there was an animal in my sock. So why am I telling you this story and what are we wanting to dig into today? So I'm wanting to talk today about how perceived authority, feeding us narratives, as well as cultural assumptions, can strongly influence our views of reality. So both myself and my friend in that moment, we both heard the same talk. And the second I felt something in my sock because of what I had heard the night before, filtered my view to only assume that it was either an unwanted critter in my sock. And my brain could not even process that it could be another option. And this is such a powerful example of how filters, really strongly influence our perception of reality. So when we are thinking about our beliefs, we have to really slow down sometimes and try and be open to acknowledging the fact that we have filters. We have things that we have been told that we believe that sometimes aren't true. So examples that I hear a lot when it comes to movement and how people perceive themselves and how they can relate to exercise and movement is I hear a lot of filters from people like, I'm not flexible enough for yoga, or I'm not strong enough to do this exercise, or I'm not good at self-care, which is a huge one, especially in the birth world. I also hear like, this is just the way my family is. It's genetic. Like we can't touch our toes. We can't, we're just inflexible, or we're just, you know, a certain way. And one example of this in my own life is a story that I told myself. That's a phrase I love from Brené Brown. This, what I'm talking about today, goes really well and very hand in hand with what Brené Brown shares in her latest Netflix special. If this topic in general is interesting to you, I highly recommend that after this podcast, you jump over there and watch Brené Brown's Netflix special because super good. But so that's her phrase that I have implemented in my own life as far as the phrase of the story I'm telling myself is. So the story I used to tell myself was that I had a sweet tooth. So me and my grandpa, we were super bonded when I was younger because we both had quote unquote sweet tooths. We would always stay up late at night and we would eat ice cream together and we had our favorite candies together. And we just, that was a way that we bonded. So I am not villainizing sugar. I think it can be a very, you know, food in general can be a very bonding thing. But for me, in my own life, what happened was I became a sugar addict. And I don't say that lightly. I don't say that as a joke. Like, it was my coping mechanism. It is what I went to when I was overwhelmed or when I was feeling emotional, when I was really happy, when I was really sad. Like, that was an outlet for me to as a way to process and handle my emotions. So again, coping mechanisms in and of themselves are not bad. We need to find ways to cope and manage our feelings and our emotions. But the story I told myself was, this is the way I am. That was the narrative and the phrasing around my sugar addiction. And when I was confronted with this, I confronted myself. Like, I landed in a place where I was ready to look at it. And I think we all need to have grace with ourselves. We all have ways where we're all in a certain place in our healing journey. So some of us are in the beginning, the middle, towards experiencing freedom in an area. But for me, in the very beginning, I wasn't able to, I needed that coping mechanism for postpartum depression. Like, it wasn't time for me to confront it. But when it became time for me to confront it, I was in a more healed place, a more stable place, and I knew this is time to process it. The first starting point for me in changing how I talked about my sugar addiction was to call it a sugar addiction. And shifting how we state things, one, saying those things can sound really harsh. Like, going from "I have a sweet tooth" to "I have a sugar addiction," it can almost sound really harsh and negative. But what's really happening for me was I changed my vocabulary from being one of a passive, more of a powerless mentality of, this is just the way it is, this is who I am, it's in my genetics. And if all those statements were true, then I was in a very disempowered place to be able to do anything about it. But when I was able to put all the things on the table and really analyze it and think about it, I was able to rephrase my mindset. And even just changing the words around it, it was like, okay, if this is a sugar addiction, if I am in a space to be able to confront that, then I have some power and some authority over something that is actually controlling my life. And that is a much more actual hopeful statement. So while initially it can sound a little harsh and like in your face, also one thing to note about my personality and myself, so just something to filter what I'm saying through, is I'm a very black or white direct person. I very much appreciate someone being very direct and clear with me. Like, the example is, I just remember being a high schooler and going shopping at the mall with my friends. And I had this one friend who I love going shopping with, because if I came out in something that just wasn't for my body type or wasn't my personality, she would not sugarcoat it. She wouldn't just automatically say, "Yes, that looks amazing." She would say, "No, like, go change, like, take it off." And I loved that directness, because that's just more how I'm wired. So when I'm coaching myself, I am extremely direct with myself because that works for me. So if you need to be a little softer and a little more gentle, like, please know yourself and coach yourself in a way where you know you'll be able to receive it and it will feel encouraging and life-giving to you. But for myself, being really direct is actually incredibly helpful. So again, there's one thing that's super powerful, is just shifting the way we state things from being a really powerless statement to a empowered statement. So instead of saying, like, "I'm just too inflexible for yoga," you could maybe state it just as accurately, but you could say something like, "I can't touch my toes." Both of those statements may feel true, but if you say something like, "I can't touch my toes," there's room in that statement for things to shift and for things to change. It's just, right now you can't touch your toes. That doesn't mean that yoga is inaccessible to you or any other form of movement. It just means that you would have to accommodate it, modify it, work around the fact that you aren't as flexible as someone else who may be super flexible. And it's really powerful to dive into our beliefs around anything. But I specifically today wanted to talk about our beliefs around self-care, because many of us are caretakers in one way or another in our lives. Maybe we're parents. If we're in the birthing community, we have a strong motivation to serve our clients, to be a form of a caretaker in one way, shape, or form for our families, for our community. And when we talk about self-care, there's a few driving factors that can provide resistance to this idea. And one of them can be time. Like, we don't have time to take care of ourselves. That's very common, and we have very busy lives. And my hand is raised over here. Like, I totally get it. Like, my joke before basically my body broke and I was in a position to have to confront my beliefs around self-care. So before that happened, I used to joke and just say I could sleep when I was dead, which it's kind of a very crude way to talk about myself. But that was the state of mind I was in. It was very like I am on the bottom rung as far as importance or time or any of that, as far as valuing myself over anyone else. Like everyone else's needs were definitely a higher hierarchy than what I placed on myself. And I was really confronted with my beliefs when obviously my body broke and basically waved the right white flag and said, okay, we can't do this anymore. Like, pay attention to me. Like I'm not working with this system here. But at one point, someone asked me, like, if I slowed down and I imagine my very best friend, like the person I love the most in the world, who supports me, who loves me, who's always there for me, the one who is just like so near and dear to my heart. If I, because I love them and I value them, what are some of the habits or priorities I would want to see them implement in their own lives because I want what's best for them and I love them? And then, you know, mentally processing, like, if I want that for someone I deeply love, why don't I want that for myself? Why, you know, what is kind of blocking that self-love, that self-value? And if you come from any kind of a religious background too, which I grew up in the Christian church, there's also an added layer too of not wanting to be selfish and not wanting to, you know, to put others' needs in front of your own. And it seems so right. But there's this mindset shift that needs to happen as far as like, I can't pour out from an empty cup. Like, what if this thriving life versus surviving, to me, the best imagery I have that at least resonates with me is trying to pour from a mostly empty cup, like you just see a couple drips coming out, versus coming from an overflow. Like my cup is just sitting there and this water is just overflowing, like out and out and out, and my cup stays consistently full. And to me, that's the best image of a thriving life. Like it doesn't mean that I keep it all for myself, but I do have to be full for that overflow to spill out. And for me, I was having to question, like, is that idea of having a thriving life, is it really too good to be true? Because for myself, I had a lot of narratives around what being a good mom and being a good wife and being a good friend and being a good at my career. Like, to me, that did not equate a thriving life. Like, I had to confront the belief that it was either or and not both and. So I had to move into this place instead of saying I'm bad at self-care or I can sleep when I'm dead, which again, is they're not very loving statements at all. I had to shift into just being blunt with myself because that works really well for me. And I had to just verbalize, I don't prioritize self-care right now for myself. And it's very powerful when we start talking in a way that opens up possibilities. So if you don't know anything about neuroscience, which I love, I don't know much at all. Like I've read some books and listened to podcasts and I just scraped the surface of studying neuroscience. But the little bit that I do know that the brain is always looking to prove itself right. So if you believe something, your brain is going to work very hard to look for things that confirm this. So if I say I'm bad at self-care, my brain is going to work extremely hard to prove myself right. If I believe like I am always going to be tired, my brain is going to look to confirm that. If I believe whatever my beliefs are, my brain is going to work very hard to validate and to build a case to support that belief. So one other powerful practice. So just to get a little more nitty gritty, let's get a little more detailed. Because I love implementation, like being able to say practice this because that's the way my brain works. Like, I want a checklist. I want to implement and practice so that I can see a shift and that it's not just all theoretical and feels more out there. So this mindset shift around self-care can be really helpful for your business. Like, if you believe I'm bad at accounting, or I'm too introverted to be good at the job I really dream of, or we all have our own narratives around whatever, around your health, around your wellness, around your physical body, around your family and how you interact with your community. We all have beliefs, and not all of them are bad, but some of them might not be serving you. All of us have beliefs, at least a few, that aren't serving us. And so not everything is inside of our control. Like, granted, like, there are just some things that happen that are just straight bad. It doesn't matter what you believe. It just is like, it's just bad. Like, it's not okay. But there are things that are inside of our control, especially the way we view life, what's going on between our two ears. And one of the tools that I love is from Byron Katie. And she has this mindset shift protocol, 4 questions that she says you should ask yourself. So when you have a belief that surfaces, I'll tell you the questions and then I'll talk you through an example in my own life. So the first question is this true? The second question is, can you absolutely know that it's true? And then the third question is, how do you react or what happens when you believe this thought? And then the fourth question would be, who would you be without this thought? So all of these questions I will have in the show notes if you want to go back and look it over, or just type in like Byron Katie's 4 questions in Google and this will come up. So I love these questions because our reality seems so true, like the mouse in the sock. That was my reality and there was no other option in my mind at that moment, because I had my filters, I had my perception, I had authority that had spoken things into existence in my mind, and I had my best friend who heard the same thing, and so she was tracking with me. Like, there was so much in place in that situation. While it's silly, it's a really powerful example of how preconceived notions filter how we experience reality in that moment. And so for me, the question is, I'll just use the mouse example first, and then I'll use a real example of, is it true? Is there a mouse in my sock? Of course, in the moment, the initial reaction is yes. Yes, this is true. Of course, this is true. and then the second question, like, makes you think a little bit slower, which is what I love about this, is, can you absolutely know that it's true? Like, 100% without, beyond a shadow of a doubt, do you know this is 100% true? And that's where it causes us to slow down and be like, well, okay, not, I don't for sure know. And that brain space, when we tell our brain that we are not 100% sure, if we're not 100% sure, that allows our brain to start looking for other options. It basically opens up the nervous system to be like, oh, okay, maybe there's another option. And then you're super powerful, super smart brain actually starts going to work for you to find other options if there are other options that are true. And so how would I react if, or what happens when you believe this thought? So me believing that there's a mouse in my sock caused me to panic. It caused me to freak out. It caused anxiety. it was big feelings that were negative and it wasn't a super fun experience. And so who would I be without that thought? If I didn't believe there was a mouse in my sock, I would feel more empowered. I would feel more curious. I would feel more brave to explore what was actually going on. And so that is the process that I use in my own life. So a more serious example would be like my sugar addiction. So I'm a sugar addict, or just even like I'm addicted. I'm a sugar addict, going back a step further to where I was, as far as I just have a sweet tooth. Like, it's genetic. This is who I am. This is how I'm wired. I have a sweet tooth. 100% I believe this. And if I ask myself, is it true? you know, your initial, again, the first reaction is, yes, yes, this is true. I've got so much evidence. I could prove it to you a million times over. I'm powerless. And my grandpa's the same way. I'm the same way. Like, this is the way it is. And then if I ask myself if it's absolutely true, I would then slow down and realize, well, I don't know. And just that opening right there, the I don't know to something that initially we just were like, I'm 100% sure. When we open ourselves up to, I'm not sure. This could be, I'm too introverted to be an exceptional doula, or I am not smart enough to get through midwifery school, or I can't serve the birthing community if I haven't birthed my own children. Like, whatever it is that surfaces in you, I'm not good enough at math to do the accounting for my own business. Whatever it is that surfaces, there is like this initial, yes, it's true. And then the second question, but is it absolutely true? Do you 100% know that it's true? And when we open that door up to like, maybe not, it is so powerful to see what the brain will do. And then how do you react? And what happens when you believe this thought? When I believe that I am just genetically wired to have to eat the sugar, then I eat the sugar. Like, I don't even fight it. I feel powerless. I feel shame. I feel all kinds of negative emotions. And it manifests in a very negative way in my own life. And then who would I be without that thought? If I didn't believe that I was a sugar, like, genetically predisposed to have all the sugar and chocolate and ice cream and all the things, then that opens up my brain to process and imagine what it would be like. And there's so much power in allowing our brain to just open itself up to certain realities. Our brain is so powerful and it wants to work for us. And so when we open ourselves, just opening ourselves up to there's a possibility that there is a solution out there. We don't have to even come up with a solution on our own. But if we say, I believe there could be a solution out there to my problem that I'm not 100% disempowered, but I maybe could be empowered to somehow figure out how to solve this, your brain will go to work in overdrive trying to find that solution. And it's so cool to see our brains start working for us in that way. So the other thing to do that really solidifies this process through the four questions is once you've opened yourself up to maybe this isn't 100% true, then imagine yourself in three different scenarios of how the new example is true. So the new example would be, I am not a sugar addict. I am free of my sugar addiction. Then I can either think of three times that I did not just automatically give in to sugar, or I imagine three times. So sometimes we have to start with imagining, and then our brain will kind of surface other memories that solidify the new belief. So our brain, again, like I mentioned, is always looking to prove us right. So if rather than saying this is true, period, and I open myself up to new a belief system, my brain will go to work trying to solidify that. And it's so powerful. So I just encourage you to try and practice this around different things that make you feel powerless. So when you have a situation that comes up and you feel very powerless and very discouraged, or some kind of very big negative feeling, to take the time to slow down and ask yourself these four questions invites your brain to go to work for you and encourages you to just rely on the ridiculously smart brain that you have, because everyone's brain is amazing. They don't even know the depths of the brain and what it can do for us. But what we do know is it will work for us. So when we open ourselves up to new possibilities, it will go to work for us. So if you have tried this or are going to try this method, I would love to hear what surfaces for you. So remembering how our brains are wired, and if we present them with more options, suddenly we can see them. I know your lives are full of thriving opportunities, and I'm thrilled to practice alongside of you as we all move into seeing the beauty and possibilities of this life, both professionally and personally. So I'm going to wrap up this conversation on that note. If self-care specifically is a sticking point for you, and you want to dive a little bit deeper into your own conscious and subconscious beliefs around this, I've created a self-care journaling practice for you, which can be found in the show notes of the show at thrivingbirthworker.com, episode 11. If you know another birth worker who needs to hear this message, go ahead and share this podcast with them. And if you're enjoying these conversations, if you could rate, subscribe, and leave me a message, I would love to hear your thoughts. So I'm so grateful for you, for your time, for your service to this community. I'm grateful to be on this journey with you into a thriving and abundant life. I hope you have a wonderful week, and we'll talk to you soon. The information and discussion provided on this podcast are not intended and should not be construed as medical advice. If you have a medical concern, you should consult with an appropriately licensed physician or healthcare provider.